KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on the Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. This week, we're revisiting our conversation with Tony McNamara, recorded well before the strike. His viciously satirical series, The Great, follows young Empress Catherine's adventures in 18th century imperial Russia. In McNamara's version, that's a world with lots of sex, swearing, and violence. The series has just returned for its third season, and Hulu, typical for a streamer, hasn't told McNamara much about who's watching, but he's fine with that.
You sort of assume it's going well because they renew it, but you're not locked into what's the ratings this week or what's the data. So there's a freedom in that. You are just like, we're creating 10 hours and in a year everyone's going to see it, and that'll be exciting for all of us and hopefully exciting for the audience.
Tony McNamara talks about his fascination with Catherine the Great and transporting the world he created for her from the stage to the small screen. But first, a banter special. Matt Bellany talks to Writers Guild negotiator David Goodman about the ongoing strike. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW.
I'm Matt Bellany, filling in for Kim Masters, and our guest banterer today is David Goodman, who is the co-chair of the negotiating committee of the Writers Guild of America. Welcome, David.
Thanks, Matt. Great to be here.
All right. So we're going to talk about what's going on in the strike and the status of the negotiations or the non-negotiations. But I got to ask about this HBO Max debacle. I mean, we saw today that there was an apology from Warner Brothers Discovery because they relaunched their Max platform yesterday, and whoops, they got rid of writing credits and directing credits and instead lumped everybody into this creators bundle where, hilariously, Martin Scorsese was listed like third or fourth in the creators of Raging Bull. And surprise, surprise, the guilds did not enjoy that. And it comes in the middle of, you know, a strike on the writer's behalf and the negotiation on the director's behalf. And they apologize. So what do you make of this apology and how this happened?
Well, I mean, I don't quite know what's involved in the rollout of a new streaming service. So, I mean, I'm not there, so I don't know what happened. It does read to me as just a screw up. Somebody did something, thought, oh, this will be easier than listing everybody's credits. And they didn't check with legal. The fact is, even though it is a contract violation for both WGA and DGA, we're actually on strike, so we don't have a contract, but DGA still does, and they're in the middle of negotiations with them. So obviously, that probably accidentally read as a slap in the face to them in the middle of their negotiation. And the fact that they turned around so quickly, it was clear somebody made a mistake. It didn't make it up the flagpole, and they turned it around. But it also speaks to what can happen in this new model of these giant companies and what we, you know, the protections we have being trod under in the name of expediency.
So we're now in the third week of the strike, and you guys have made a lot of noise. You're out there picketing every day. You're doing a lot of media interviews. You are showing up at commencement speeches and helping the students of Boston University jeer the CEO of Warner Discovery. I assume you think that this action is going well, but what do you say to the people that believe that none of that matters, that it's all noise, that the writers can stomp up and down and scream and get people to honk for them, but it doesn't really do anything to impact the negotiation?
The most important thing about a strike is that we're depriving them of our work.
Sure, but you could do that without doing media interviews and embarrassing them at colleges.
Well, just putting a fine point on it, it was the students who booed him at the commencement address.
True, but there were WGA members
on the outside, but inside, what was happening was people showing support, and that is an important piece. That people understand that the things we're fighting for are not just about us. We're talking about making a living in a field where the companies that we work for make huge profits off of our work. So it's not just depriving them of work, which is the most important thing, but letting people know that we're serious, that this is serious, and all the support that we're getting, and all you refer to it as noise, I refer to it as support, as labor solidarity from all these unions and all these people showing up to say, yeah, we get it.
Isn't a big part of this also to maintain the solidarity of the membership? Because you had an extraordinarily high percentage of your members vote to authorize the strike. It was above, 98%. And you've now got, I'd say, extraordinarily strong solidarity amongst the membership during these early days of the strike. Now, that becomes harder and harder as the pain is inflicted as we get into month two, month three, month six, to maintain that level of solidarity. And I think a lot of the actions that the Guild takes to go public with things and to be out there every day and showing support for the other guilds, you help your own people stay committed. Do you worry at all a little bit about that being able to maintain that level of solidarity?
Well, that's where that's the most important thing. And so I appreciate you saying that, because that is absolutely my biggest concern, and the biggest concern of the leadership is that the membership understand that this fight is about them, and that the sacrifices that they're making for all of us are not only appreciated and necessary, but also things that we're keeping a close eye on. That if members don't feel that this strike is worth it, that then the value of the strike goes away. And so, yes, that's where all our concern is. I'm not, you said month six. I don't want to assume that it has to go that long. I think these companies are hurting from this strike, and this side of the negotiation where it is just picketing and it is, these demonstrations of support, which is an important part of the negotiation, gets those companies back to the table and addressing our concerns. But yes, it's a day-to-day check-in with members. That's why leadership is out on the picket lines every day talking to members and in constant contact, because how they feel is the most important thing.
You say that the companies are hurting from this, but obviously the other side of that argument is that these are companies that have seen their stock prices go down significantly this past year and a half. They are looking for ways to cut costs. Disney, $5 billion in costs. Others are doing the same. What about the argument that these companies, at least in the short term, are going to benefit from some of these costs coming off the books?
Well, I mean, it's always an interesting argument to me because I've heard that before, they're going to benefit from this. Most of the companies that we're in business with are there to make this stuff. And they also plan very far in advance, release dates, the launching of new shows. And so the idea that maybe there's a short-term benefit to a stock price by cutting costs, the fact is, that might be true this quarter. It's not going to be true next quarter. That they have to, they'll figure out some way to cut costs and find some benefit from the strike. But overall, no, we're hurting them. We're shutting down productions, things that they are counting on, that their investors are counting on to see on their platforms. And so, I don't believe that that's a strategy of theirs.
So the AMPTP has chosen to move on to the directors, try to make a deal with the Directors Guild. The Screen Actors Guild, SAG-AFTRA, is also making noises about a strike. They are seeking a strike authorization vote, which we assume will be authorized. What is the level of communication between you and the other guilds? And is there a quasi or stealth coordination on how to best leverage all of these deadlines and negotiations to raise everybody's boats?
I think that our staffs are in communication with each other. There isn't that kind of lockstep coordination that I feel like you maybe think might be happening. It's not. That to me is a hope for the future.
Why not?
Well, that historically these unions have been divided. This is the really a first that in our strike, we're getting support from SAG and DGA and IATSE and the Teamsters in just such profound ways. But it happened relatively quickly. To change the way negotiations in Hollywood work will take time to get these unions together and in lockstep. For so many years, these kind of myths propagated by the AMPTP that strikes aren't worth it, that each union had their own interests, and yet still they made us pattern bargain and take whatever every other union got, and that it's taken a long time for that change to happen, and so it's going to take a longer time for these unions to get in lockstep. Having said that, there's a lot more open communication with both these unions. You have members of these unions on our picket line, which we so value. In terms of what's going on with DGA and SAG, they're their own unions and they're going to keep their own counsel, but they're talking to us and there's open communication. I mean, you know, I don't think anyone expects us to be together in the way you're saying at this moment, but the fact that we're showing this kind of support for each other is very meaningful.
Thank you, David. That's David Goodman, co-chair of the negotiating committee of the WGA. I'm Matt Bellany of Puck News. Thanks for listening.
Hulu's drama series, The Great, set in 18th century Imperial Russia, is awash in sex, swearing, blood, and vodka. Far from a sudsy historical drama, the show is a razor-sharp social satire. Tony McNamara is the creator, writer, and executive producer of the show, which bills itself as an occasionally true story about Russian Empress Catherine the Great. An Australian playwright and screenwriter, McNamara got an Oscar nomination for the script of The Favorite, another 18th century royal romp. In the second season of The Great, Catherine, played by Elle Fanning, became the Empress of Russia and pushes for progressive change across the empire.
I have been a lying German because I will be freeing the serfs. Today! And yes, I yelled that bit for effect. And yes, you will pay them a wage, and they will buy goods and services and create another economy, and they will strive for more and invest themselves in Russia, and the filthy stain of serfdom will be off your hearts, and unfortunately, you may actually end up richer, but I actually don't care whether it costs you. It will be done, and there's no amount of threat or spittle that you can aim at me that will change my mind on that. Get used to the future, gentlemen, because it's coming.
I'm going to be honest and say it's not like I was an early fan because, and not because I don't like the show, but because I didn't think I would want to see it. I didn't know what the show was. In other words, I had no idea. And then sometime along, I think my colleague Dan Feinberg, who is a brilliant critic at The Hollywood Reporter, there was a review that I trust his judgment. I realized this is not what I think it is at all, and I went crazy for it. So this story has a happy ending. But not to dwell too much on my hangups, you know, I always think, well, how do you know and how many liberties can you take? Now, clearly you take extreme liberties.
A few, yeah.
But do you worry? I mean, do you say to yourself, the detail should be right and the dress should be right and they wouldn't have eaten that? Or do you just think we have license to do as we please here?
I think we have a baseline. I mean, the show's a sort of its own period. Like, you know, in some ways it's like our own created period, but it comes off a sort of baseline of a certain reality around, it's sort of even in the design, even though we push a bunch of stuff, there's a sort of, the designers are all basing it on a certain period. And then in terms of the writing, I always have things that are true. Often they're the things that don't seem true. And
as in life itself. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And then the rest is sort of me making things up or me knowing. I always have a few tentpole things I know she did that even if I don't do them exactly as it happened, I kind of think, oh, this is the sort of spirit of what she was doing. So within that, so that it doesn't get into, you don't drown in just boring period detail of what actually happened or what people say happened or so, yeah, so that it's sort of a show I would want to watch, essentially.
Right. So, of course, the thing that, like, people know about Catherine the Great is this notion about the sex with the horse, which I think is what maybe got you interested in this initially.
I I think initially I found out that's all I knew. And then I can't remember whether I watched a doco or I read something and I went, oh, well, that's interesting. It's such a salacious detail that is what is known about this woman. And then when I dug a little deeper, I was like, it's quite contemporary that this headline about her life has no reflection of what she was actually like. And turned out really it was a sort of political hatchet job rumor to kind of undermine her. So I found that interesting and found it kind of a contemporary idea that our whole life can be reduced to this sort of joke or punchline. And I found that sort of funny and terrible at the same time.
Yes. To be clear, we have no reason to believe that Catherine the Great ever had any kind of dalliance with animals.
I definitely think it is not true and was actually just a political...
a hit job.
Yeah.
I haven't gone down the rabbit hole, a little bit, because I'm interested in Catherine the Great now because, I mean, you got me there with this. She's like the begats of Catherine the Great. I mean, she is related to Prince Charles and Prince William and Prince George. Like the current line of succession in the British monarchy descends from...
I had no idea.
Are you kidding?
Wow. No, of course not. I'm not kidding at all. No, I've been told things about her that I'm stunned by. I'm like, wow. How about that?
Well, apparently, yes, that line continues. Yeah. Check me if I'm wrong, historians, but this is what I read as I was getting intrigued by the Catherine the Great of it all. But she is a woman of parts, too. I mean, she comes over to Russia as this very young girl. You have a lot of material to work with there in terms of this really amazing woman of intellectual force.
Yeah, I think that was what really, I think in a way her youth was what won me to the story originally. I was like, how did someone that age come to a country where she didn't speak the language, she didn't know the country's culture, and somehow sort of end up running the country and deposing her husband and all in her early 20s? And so I found that really interesting as a character, like who's that force of nature at a time when the Enlightenment was happening. And she just seemed really interesting and really like, you know, in terms of our times of a desire for change and a reaction against change. And she was right in the middle of the same thing, you know. So I found that an interesting character.
You have been living with this character, I think, since you wrote a play that was performed at the Sydney Theatre Company in 2008.
Yeah.
So you have been with Catherine for a long time now. And I guess intermittently. I mean, you did this before.
Intermittently,
yeah,
yes.
You wrote The Great, I think, before you did The Favorite, which is another period piece with historical characters that you did your thing with, you know, you took your license with,
true,
right?
True. Yeah, we did take license. Yeah, I wrote the play and then Yorgos, who directed The Favourite, had read, I think I'd written a film script of it and he read that and hired me to do The Favourite.
And A Favourite, what drew you to that story?
I think it was just such a great political, personal story. It just seemed a really interesting female driven story, and not even just like a great characters and really just people desperate to get what they wanted and not behaving well to get it. And I like stories like that.
I'm sort of intrigued by the process of pitching The Great. I mean, it was a play. I mean, did somebody say to you, let's do this? Or did an agent say, let's do this? Who said, let's do this?
Marion McGowan, who's an Australian film producer who saw the play, who I had worked with before. And she said it should be a film. And then so we started that process, but I was never happy with, you know, I wanted more time. And then I'd been working in TV a bit and eventually I thought, oh, I think it'll be better as TV. I think I don't need an hour and a half. I need like 30 hours. So we went down that road and found Hulu, who kind of sort of loved the idea, even though they were not sure what I was going to do. They were kind of like, it sounds great. And they liked, Alan Nick liked the idea of being in it. And so, yeah, it all just came together in that way.
I hadn't seen the play, of course, because, you know, I wasn't in Australia in 2008. Unfortunately, I would have liked to visit Australia, I'm sure, in 2008. But the sort of the character of the, you know, this is a show with a tremendous amount of swearing, you know, Catherine swears, everybody swears prolifically.
Everybody swears.
Right. And there's all kinds of violence, but, you know, some of it is very grim. Of course, violence is grim, but somehow, I don't know how to describe it. It's violence
It stays fun, we like to think.
Yeah, that's fun violence. I mean, it's not cartoonish and it's horrifying, but it's it's in that tone of it's not trying to be a horror movie or some kind of NC-17 kind of thing. Yes. And all of that was part of the play? I mean, was it, or did you have to say, look, you see what I do in the play? Because I want to do it on steroids with this series.
I think obviously, yeah. I mean, the play was similar, but I guess the TV show goes further in a lot of way, you know, because there's just a bigger palette. There's an ability to create the world in a way you can't with a play. You can only create so much on, you know, a few boards and lights, etc. So just, I think that a TV show just gives you so much scope to create a world and give it an energy and give it a sort of anarchic, sort of violent feel, which is sort of what I wanted.
Mm. And they went for this at Hulu. What? They were like,
well, yeah. I think, yeah, they did. They were very great and are very great partners because they'd read the pilot script and bought that and I'd pitched them what it was. But even in script form, you were sort of unsure how much comedy it was and how much drama it was and how they would sit together. But then they, you know, they went, go make a pilot and show us what you mean. And they really just let me go do that. And then bring it back and go, this is what I mean. And they loved it. So they've kind of always been a great partner for us in terms of the boldness of the show and just backing what we are trying to do.
And that must have been an expensive pilot. I mean, we're talking period piece, elaborate costumes.
Yeah, they're not. Yes. Yeah, they're various, not cheap.
I'm just kind of processing that they said yes to something that feels like, you know, a tremendous gamble, honestly. Like, I don't know how they knew it would be good. Just trying to figure that out.
I don't think they did know. I think they trust their instincts. And I think Jordan, who runs Hulu, you know, I think they never had it in their heads to make a period show. It wasn't something they ever thought they would do. But then I think they liked the script and thought it would be something different. It was had a bit of a unique, yeah, exactly. And it had a bit of a unique feel. So I think they were just ready to take the leap that it might be something, you know. So I think that is what's great about them. They're very sort of bold in that and in backing their creators.
Coming up after the break, Tony McNamara talks about changing the plan for The Great after realizing his ensemble cast really wanted to stay together for the long haul. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes. Join Jacqueline Coley as she hosts a brand new podcast, Scene on the Screen. Meet the innovative people at NBC Universal as they share their journeys, inspirations, and the movies that define them. Each episode is an intimate and fun conversation about the impact of film. Scene on the Screen is available now wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're revisiting our pre-strike conversation with Tony McNamara from last May. He joined us from London, where he was busy with the recently premiered season 3 of The Great. The Hulu show stars Elle Fanning as the young Catherine the Great and Nicholas Holt as her husband Peter. In season 2, Catherine, having pulled off a coup in which she deposed Peter, lets him back into the palace under house arrest. She also lets him back into her bed.
I'm a busy empress with few activities beyond my work and a line between me and the court that must be preserved to maintain my power. And I was also very hungover with a terrible headache, so you seemed the most efficient way to get my needs met.
Seems ruthless and clever, so very you.
It was in no way personal.
Disagree?
I'm sure you f***ed 100 women who meant nothing but the sating of longing.
As we are in love, it is not an apt analogy.
We are not in love. You are my prisoner, and I perhaps overstepped the boundaries of our relationship. Apologies.
Now, am I remembering right that you had visualized multiple seasons of this, like 5, 8? I can't remember the number. I think I read.
I think I pitched like 6, but it was a bit like Peter Morgan does on The Crown, where I wanted to jump periods of her life. But then once we got in this series and started writing it, and then we, you know, created this ensemble that I just love as an ensemble of their work, but I also love working with them as people, an amazing Peter and Catherine and their chemistry. Then I was just like, there was plenty of story and I just wanted to not jump time. I was just like, I feel like this story has legs beyond 2 seasons, young Catherine. And there was lots of story to tell. There was a sense of all the ensemble and the family of the show wanting to be together for a longer time and keep making something that we loved making. So I think in the end, in Hulu, kind of were happy to keep making it with young Catherine, you know. So I did change what it was going
to
be.
Yes, at this point, if you know, and again, to mention Netflix, you know, nothing is getting much past 2-3 seasons. So hopefully this will be a Crown-like exception. It already is. So you're at 3 at least.
Hopefully, so. Yeah, and it is tough at the moment getting... I think because there's so many shows and it's hard to keep people watching more than a couple of seasons, you know, I think that's part of the issue.
Is it a tenderhook situation for you? Or I mean, I don't know what feedback you can get from a streamer in terms of, you know, they don't share much information on data, you know.
No, not really, but I don't mind that. I really want to know. Just like,
you don't need the anxiety?
No, I'm happy obliviously. Just thinking no one watches it and I'm writing a show that only I care about. That keeps it sort of anxiety-free for me to just kind of go, oh, well, let's just keep making this great show. I wonder if anyone watches it. and clearly we know people do, but it's not. We haven't got data and we don't have, you know, it's sort of, you sort of assume it's going well because they renew it, but you're not locked into what's the ratings this week or what's the data. So there's a freedom in that. You know, you're not sort of week to week wondering what your numbers are. You are just like, we're creating 10 hours and in a year everyone's going to see it and that'll be exciting for all of us and hopefully exciting for the audience. There's a great freedom in that creatively.
Mm. Did they remind me if they dropped it all at once when it came on first?
Yeah, they did. Yeah.
And are they continuing that strategy? Because that's going out of fashion, you know? I mean, what I'm finding now as a viewer of certain shows, I am confused with limited series, especially. I'm like, wait, they gave me 3 and now I wait until Thursday and that's when they're going to give me the next one. And yeah. I'm like, they're reinventing TV. That's what they're inventing, that kind of thing where you know that if you're committed to a show and you really want to see the episode when it drops, you've got to remember Thursday at this time and that's when you can see it. It's kind of funny that they're going, I mean, I felt like, you know, this is this big swing that's finally going back to a lot of things that were old Hollywood and that some of the tech companies coming in were disdainful of.
Yeah. Yeah, I do think, I mean, yeah, we drop all at the same time, but I do, that's a cool, I kind of like that model because it does get people engaged and then it's sort of like this slight event that can work. I guess it works for you in that people are really invested or a lot of people maybe forget, you know. So I don't know what works best either way. I mean, this seems to work for us, which is why they keep doing it. But, you know, some shows really work all at once. Some seem to work rolled out very slowly. So yeah.
I mean, I don't know if we have a scientific answer to what creates the greater engagement, because on the one hand, waiting for the next one is time tested, and on the other hand, I had a great time once I decided to watch the show binging away for 2 seasons. I had a lot of fun with that.
Oh, good.
Tony McNamara is the creator, showrunner, and executive producer of the Emmy-nominated series The Great on Hulu. Well, thank you, Tony. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, pleasure.
And that's The Business. Melissa Yeager-Miller and Joshua Farnham produced and edited today's program with help this week from Seth Van Meter, Paul Smith, Nick Lamponi, and John Meek, who mixed the show. You can stream The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts on the KCRW app. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on the Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.